Welcome to NC Valor, hosted by Dr. Alan Marshall. NC Valor honors our North Carolina veterans by sharing with you their stories of courage, bravery, and valor. NC Valor is proudly sponsored by Green Dreams Landscape Management, where dreams are grown. Whatever your dreams, our team at Green Dreams will work with you to make them a reality. Now here's your host, Dr. Alan Marshall.
Welcome to NC Valor, the radio show that brings you the valor of North Carolina through its veterans and their stories. I want to thank Green Dreams Landscape Management for sponsoring the show and making it possible. I'm Dr. Alan Marshall. I'm the head of school of Sandhills Classical Christian School. And today we have a return visitor today. We have retired Army veteran Jason Hauk that's going to be with us today. Welcome.
Thanks.
Jason was here several months ago. Talking about his experiences, and then also at the time he was still finishing up his book, and which is a modern translation or interpretation of the Quran, and so that's what we're going to be talking about a lot today. But for those of the audience that weren't necessarily or didn't hear you the first time, let's kind of go through your story, and then we'll get right into your book.
Sure.
When and where were you born?
I was born in Vermont in the early 1970s. And then we moved to Florida when I was 10 years old.
Okay. So you spent a lot of time in Florida, including with the high school there?
Yeah, went to high school, and then at 18 enlisted in the Army and the infantry.
Okay. And you had a tour as an enlisted troop?
Right. I was private through sergeant at the 82nd at Fort Bragg.
Okay. And then I think you got out?
Yeah, I got a Green to Gold scholarship. Okay. And went to school at Auburn University.
Went to Auburn. Okay, and graduated, I think, in 2000?
Correct, 2000.
All right. And then when you graduated, you ended up coming right back here to Fort Bragg?
Yeah, I was lucky enough to get my platoon leader time back at Fort Bragg with an engineer sapper platoon.
Okay. Now, that kind of gets you in to the time as an officer in the Army. But there was also some time there that kind of started you off in your interest in the Middle East. And I think that started, back in 1996, a tour you had at UAE?
Correct. When I was with the 504, my company was sent to the UAE. We trained with their special forces in the United Arab Emirates. And that really got me interested in starting in 96, so a couple decades ago, in studying Islam and the Middle Eastern culture, and that would follow throughout my career.
Okay. And then later on, you were assigned to Afghanistan, I think, in 2002?
Correct. 2002, I went in with the 82nd to work on an airfield, and then I ended up working with the Afghan government on a daily basis, assisting General Eikenberry as we built the Afghan army. Mm-hmm. And so I really got to learn a lot more about Muslim culture and interact with the Afghan government.
Okay. And at some point, you went into the FAO business. Can you explain that?
Right. So I got picked up into the Foreign Area Officer Program in the Army. There's about 1,000 FAOs at any one time in the Army, and they do the diplomatic defense policy intelligence work. So I ended up working with them, and I was Middle East and South Asia focused, studied Arabic and Dari, got my master's in Middle East, South Asian studies.
Okay, and that sprang from your time really with General Eikenberry?
Right. He was a FAO. I had made it to 3 stars eventually and an ambassador, but he taught me a little bit about what it's like to be a FAO as a young lieutenant. So I kept with that, and that was my dream to chase down.
Okay. What other training do you have just specifically for FAO? What kind of school you go through for that?
So everybody gets their master's degree, gets a language somewhere in the region, does some travel in the region, and then you go to the Command and General Staff College. Those are the major requirements. There's a pretty long pipeline to become a FAO.
Mm-hmm.
The Army puts a bit of money into you.
Absolutely. And then that language piece is a big part of that, right?
Correct. Yeah. If you can't get a language, you can't become a FAO, and you have to sustain that throughout your career.
So. Okay. And so that became kind of the genesis of this book that you just wrote, because the language piece was critical to that.
Right. Understanding and working in the Muslim world was critical, but if I didn't know the basics of Arabic and Dari Farsi is very similar in alphabet and structure. So that was how I was able to read through the Quran in Arabic and put it into a modern English.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think a lot of non-modern-day military folks really understand the emphasis that we need to put on language skills in across the military, but especially in our special operations and in all our diplomatic areas.
Very true. It opens so many doors, but it also, working with other people outside of America, but it also opens you to their culture. you understand the language, you understand. You have to know the history and the culture to know the language. So that makes us a better partner to anywhere we're stationed overseas.
Absolutely. Now, let's go into and just talk about your book. First, give me the title of your book and kind of give me the general outline of it.
So we're not getting too wild with the title here. It's called The Quran.
Okay.
The subtitle is A Chronological Modern English Interpretation. And that really emphasizes what my aim was with this book. Put it in chronological order. It's not how the Quran is usually structured. It usually kind of runs from longest to shortest chapter. And that's the way it's ordained in every Arabic Quran. I wanted to switch that up because it was revealed over 23 years to the Prophet Muhammad. So I wanted to put it in that 23-year order so you could see the changes in the verses as it goes through history, and you can kind of see the historical events that occur while he's getting his revelation.
And how were you able to determine that chronological order?
There's a roughly agreed upon methodology, because Islamic scholars have to know the chronological order for some of the rules that are followed in Islamic law, or Sharia is the word most people know for that. So you can take that basic chronological structure out of that. A lot of people have cataloged the way that they would have been revealed to them originally.
Okay. And I just have a question, a kind of a personal question. I've kind of had it described that some of the early verses seem to be a little more open to external, or at least a softer approach, whereas the later ones seem to be more where you get some of those verses that we hear quoted a lot of times as far as the hard edge.
I think it's helpful to see the Quran here in a chronological order.
Mm-hmm.
The beginning, it opens up like any prophet revealing a religion.
Mm-hmm.
And then as 23 years goes by, he's being persecuted by another, by his relatives and friends from another city. They actually go to war together. You know, there's some very violent passages towards the end as they start having these battles and skirmishes together. So it changes over time. You know, at the beginning, it's very open and it's inviting. It's trying to bring people into a new religion. You know, I think that happens in every religion. It kind of opens mm-hmm. up that way, and then as it goes along, it gets a little more regimented and rigid. And as he gets closer to death, you know, there's a lot more rules and ideas that come out that kind of set up the commandments, the tenets for this religion.
Mm-hmm. So that seems to me would be something to help folks to understand. You know, we get a lot of verses that are quoted, and they seem to be at odds with each other. You'll hear, you know, this maybe more hard-edged verse, and then you'll hear a more open verse. And you really have to have a little bit of that context to be able to integrate the two.
Yeah, that's what I try to do here. There's an introduction chapter that lays out kind of the story of Muhammad's life and, you know, as he grows through prophethood and his death, and then how the Quran was put together to show you how those revelations unfolded over 23 years and give some of the background in that. Because there are those ones that are always quoted, and we kind of miss the ones that aren't quoted. There's a lot of radical or extreme or fundamental mm-hmm. Islamic prayer leaders or preachers out there, and they're going to quote what they want, what supports their idea. And everybody does that in every religion. You can misuse it. But I think it's fascinating to go into, you know, say right number 62 out of 114, there's a whole page on forgiveness and mercy and reconciling with others and letting God sort things out, letting God decide. That patience and forgiveness is just as courageous as it is to fight. So a lot of people will leave those things out because it doesn't fit their mm-hmm. agenda. And I think that's where a lot of people can learn from this book. You can see the majority of the contents are not about violence or not about the word jihad or struggle. There's a lot of messages in there that are usually not heard by most people that aren't Muslim. But mm-hmm. most Muslims will hear that in mosque every day. There are a lot of things about tolerance, forgiveness, caring for elders, taking care of orphans.
Yeah, for me it kind of explains too how you can have such a wide disparity in the Muslim world, how you'll have a completely different presentation versus, you know, you see the ISIS guy holding somebody's head up.
Sure.
And you can get that range of behavior all from the same book.
Exactly. I think it's almost that fundamentalist view of religion. And one of my friends put it to me really well, and I quote it at the beginning of my book. He said that Islam is not a religion of peace or war. Islam is a religion just like any other. peace and war depend on one's interpretations and ends. And every religion over time has been misused by somebody, and then usually goes through some kind of reform and comes back to the more peaceful tenets of which that religion starts out. And you still have the outliers like the Westboro Baptists, you know, are protesting at veterans' funerals. They're way on the extreme, and they're taking the worst things you could take out of the book. Yeah, and that happens in this religion too.
And sometimes you'll hear, where is the Muslim Reformation? You know, where's that at? Well, that's going to be a very hard thing to do externally. That has to be internally driven.
Yeah, I've noticed, especially with younger people across the Muslim worlds and different Muslim cultures, and there are, you know, hundreds of Muslim cultures. It varies by county and province and, hillside and valley. But a lot of the younger people are in that, I would say they're in that phase of Reformation. They're really looking at what should be taught from the Quran, and they're starting to question those people who are very violent focused, and they seem to be preaching all the wrong values. And a lot of the younger people are asking for Muslims to take a look at how they interpret Islam. Not that the religion is wrong, but maybe the way they're hearing about it is not the best way to talk about it. So I think there's a discussion going on right now, and that's a healthy discussion, but I think you're absolutely right. It's nothing that a non-Muslim is going to do. You know, this book is just to help with that discussion.
Right. In Christianity, you kind of have a cleavage of time that arrived with Jesus Christ, where a lot of the harsh verses that you might could take independently are in that Old Testament. And then you see Jesus arrive, and then you see a different approach from that. So there's no comparative cleavage of time where you can simply put the more open before and the harsher before and after.
Sure.
So that's just a difference in history that I think they'll probably have to overcome before they get a full Reformation.
Yeah, it's interesting, as you'll note in the beginning of this book that I've written, you'll see how many Hebrew Bible or Old Testament stories are told. I think Moses is mentioned. I was surprised. I learned a lot about Moses and the Pharaoh. 215 times Moses is mentioned in the Quran. And, and in the beginning, you just get the story. I think I wrote it about 82 times, the story of Moses and the Pharaoh and what happened. So these Old Testament stories show up at the beginning, and it's discussions about prophethood and what prophets go through and those struggles that they face. And many, Abraham, Job, Joseph, many, many people are in the stories in the beginning of the Quran.
Do you think there's any, is there any trade space or working room in that Muhammad talks about the children of the book, the Jewish folks and the Christians, and in a very open way in the certain portions?
Yeah.
Can we operate in that trade space as opposed to the other? And is there anything, any progress that can be made there?
I think so. You know, most of the times that Christianity or Judaism is mentioned in here, it's to point out that people aren't always following what was laid out in the Hebrew Bible or in the New Testament. You know, even though he was an illiterate person, Muhammad was aware of these other religions. They'd been around for hundreds of years. So he knew about them, and he was able to talk about them. And he's pushing people to come back to following the text correctly. So that's the major crux of what he's trying to put across, usually when he mentions it. So I think there's room for everybody to discuss, is any religion following their religious text in the right way or the best way? And I think there's always room for that discussion.
Okay. Yeah, now let's go over, we need to talk about, you have the Quran, which is the foundation, but there's some other things that kind of form Muslim thought. And it starts all off with Muhammad.
Yeah, I think people will realize if they read through this book, and they will see that some of the most popular things that are mentioned in there, faithfulness, righteousness, forgiveness, creation, Moses, worship, the signs of God, righteousness, hell, heaven. These are the concepts you see in every book. So then you wonder, well, where are all these real extreme and fanatical ideas come from? Where's all the violence come from? If it's not the most mentioned topic, where does that come from? And generally, there's been a few sources over time. There's the hadiths that people, not all Muslims, agree upon. And these are a collection of all the things that Muhammad said during his lifetime that aren't in the Quran, that are not revelations from God. These are just things he said as a prophet. So people collected those things that he said. And there's a like I mentioned, there's a wide disagreement about which ones are accurate, which are not. But people can pull out of that, and there's different things they could pull from those. And then there's the way he lived, the sunnah, which is where the name Sunni comes from in Islam. You know, how he lived and what he allowed in his presence. And so then people would write down, well, I saw Muhammad do this, so that's okay to do because you're doing like you want to be like the prophet, or Muhammad allowed this to happen in his presence, so it must be okay with him. He's a prophet, so that's legal to do. So you get a lot of, you can get some variance. The idea is that you wouldn't follow anything in the Sunnah or the Hadiths that aren't backed up by something in the Quran. But that doesn't always happen just in any religion. People come up with their own interpretations and their own way of doing things, and it leads to some confusion about what's right and wrong.
Okay. You're listening to Talk 97.3 FM and 990 AM WEEB. We're talking to Jason Hauck about his book, The Quran, A Modern Interpretation, that it's laid out in chronological order. And we just talked about how you have the Quran and you have the Hadith and the Sunnah that make up kind of complete the Muslim thought. Now, speaking to that, what's the reception of your book been?
The majority of the reception has been really good. I'd say on the non-Muslim side, what I've heard from a lot of people is, this is the version of the Quran I wish I had seen in September 12th, 2001. I wish I could have picked this up and had a readable English book that makes it a little bit clearer for me, because the other ones were just hard to read. They sounded like Shakespeare or Beowulf.
Mm-hmm.
So I really, that was my goal. I wanted it to be easy and to read, readable. Accurate but readable, so people could get through it quickly. Then I have Muslims' responses to it. The majority of Muslims come up to me and thank me whenever I do public talks about this, or they've looked at the book and said, you know, this is good. You did something that's hard to put it into modern English and make it readable, but you didn't lose the messages that are in there. You didn't soften it. You didn't harden it. You didn't add a lot of opinion to it. You just wrote down what's in there. And then there's a small group on Muslim and non-Muslim that just don't want you to talk about Islam. You know, so I had some people come up to me at a book show and say, oh, you know, you're just going to make Muslims angry. What are you trying to do? And I said, well, I'm trying to have an open dialogue about another religion, increase tolerance through education. And then they just shake their head. No, you shouldn't do that. You should just leave it be. And I'm not sure how ignoring a problem is going to help it. And same with a very small minority of Muslims said, you shouldn't do it. You're not even Muslim. What are you doing looking at it? It's not super mixed, but I'm happy to get the good reactions from people who want to be open-minded about it. I'm not surprised. My Islamic studies mentor told me, there was going to be some people who attack you and say you just shouldn't do it. You know, who are you to interpret it? And he reminded me that, the Quran is – in the Quran, it actually states that the Quran is for all humankind. It's not just for Muslims. That would be a hard way to recruit people. And that – the Quran invites you to read it, to think about it, interpret it, and share it. And that's what I did. So, in a way, this is some weird call from God to share another religion and talk about religion and get people thinking about other religions, maybe find our similarities instead of the differences.
Okay. And for that group that you said that they would make the Muslims mad, what have you had much of that?
Not really. I haven't had any anger. I've just had a few people, questioning why would you do this? Or you must have an agenda for doing this. And usually those people haven't read the introduction chapter or even the back cover when I said, this is a book for non-Muslims. It's to help them learn more about Islam. That is it. That's all I'm trying to do, is help people have a discussion. I'll give them the facts. That's how I teach all my courses. You make your own decisions. You do what you want with the information. But I'm trying to share the facts in a readable way.
Okay, and you talked about your courses. Tell me about what you're doing and where you're teaching.
For the last year, I've been teaching at Sandhills Community College here locally. Taught a course, Introduction to Islam, Introduction to Middle East. And this fall, I'm adding a course on Afghanistan and Pakistan, and also U.S. counterterrorism policy. So I'll have all four of those going this fall. Good response. It's one of the busiest classes at Sandhills. We get 35 to 40 people in there, which is pretty big for continuing education. So that's been good. I teach at a couple other places for the DOD as well, but most of my teaching is here local.
Okay. now, I'm going to take this time since you're here. Can you give us kind of a your current assessment about what's going on in the Middle East? I know that's a big question, but I have you here, and I just want to take that opportunity for the audience.
Sure. I think one of our major areas, the longest running in Afghanistan, we're coming to a point where it's not about the number of troops we have on the ground. It's about the commitment we show to the Afghan people, to the Pakistani government, and to the enemy over there, that we are going to stand with the Afghans and continue to fight alongside them and give them what they need for a long time. Truly become an ally. I mean, NATO is in there, and I think we just had some promises from NATO and the U.S. to put more people on the ground, and not for large numbers, but for solidarity, and to show that we're going to stay there. And I think that's the end. That region felt abandoned after the Soviet Union left, and we took off, and the Pakistani and the Afghans were left with a lot of violent militants, heavily armed. So just showing we're going to be there, I think that changes. That's more the tone I think we need to set over there, that we're not going to cut and run. On the other side of things, back in Iraq and Syria, which started a little bit after Afghanistan, and we're back again, we've continued to push on the ground militarily. Unfortunately, I think the ideological side is where we have to do better, and that's what's going to be hard. Even as we push these folks out of Raqqa, as they're almost out of Mosul now, and most of Iraq, when we get deeper into Syria and Raqqa, where they're kind of holed up, ISIS's ideology is going to spread, and Al-Qaeda is going to take advantage of ISIS losses. Al-Qaeda is going to start recruiting, they already have, and they're going to push to get more of the militants to come to them. So this ideology is what we have to go after. How do they get this violent interpretation, this real radicalized way of looking at Islam? That's where we've got to have more of a discussion, and I kind of hope that's where this book can help the Americans understand that.
Well, as far as Syria, how far do we have to take that?
I think this is going to be the tricky one, and we really haven't laid out the policy yet, but that's what you have to figure out. Where do we want – what's the end state for this? Is Assad leave? Is there some kind of coalition government put in place? Is it just exterminating ISIS and then we back off and let Assad, you know, figure out what's going to happen next? You know, who's going to be the arbiters of what happens there? It's a tough decision. It's you never know how much you're helping or hurting by being involved in something in the Middle East, and we struggle with that.
Well, I noticed as we kicked out some of them out of the portions of Mosul, the local government said that the caliphate now is no longer standing. And so I seem to feel that what we've learned this whole episode is as long as the caliphate holds and maintains land, they have credibility, and it's really going to cause trouble throughout the world as people are energized and join that movement.
Yeah, every time another violent radical Islamist group stands up and say they are a caliphate or a so-called caliphate, that's especially if they hold a piece of land, that gives them the ability to recruit. And whether it's right or wrong, historically correct or an actual caliphate or not, that's all they need for the recruiting tool to bring in people, young folks from all over the world, for many different reasons, to come in and put their life on the line and die for that idea of rebuilding a caliphate that was never really a great golden era. They just assume it will be again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so that's kind of – I know I'm just an observer here, but, as a minimum, we're going to have to make sure that ISIS doesn't have and control and own land. Yep. And then after that, then that comes in that question, okay, well, then who does control the land?
Yeah, I think that's the most important part. It's getting all our partners around the world, wherever there's an unstable space, wherever there's land up for grabs, to make sure every government in the world controls their area, so you don't end up with another Afghanistan or Somalia or Yemen or Syria or Iraq, where people can come in and set up camp and start recruiting and start building an army.
Yeah, we used to call it ungoverned spaces.
Sure.
The bad guys are really good about flowing into seams and ungoverned spaces. So the world community has an interest in working together to make sure there's no ungoverned space where the bad guys will flow into.
Exactly. And I think our military forces around the world are working on that. And that's going to be the scope of where our diplomats and aid missions and military missions have to go, is finding those seams and those ungoverned spaces and helping people secure them.
Right. And then who governs those spaces? We may not be able to dictate that perfectly. And we're probably not going to be able to institute Jeffersonian democracies in those spaces. Does that sound reasonable?
Yeah, I agree. It's it's just about control, and hopefully not the worst bad guy in the world controlling it and keeping out anybody with some kind of deadly ideology.
Right. Another part of the Middle East that we didn't really get into is I think Libya is a great example, how there was a strong man governing that space, and we took him out.
Yeah, you definitely knock down a hornet's nest whenever you bring instability into a country that has stability, no matter how bad it is. You've got to be prepared to help whatever comes next to be a stable place.
Yeah, I think that's something that as Americans we can learn is before we do something, make sure we know who's next and that we have a comfort with who's going to be next.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, I know you wanted to mention another book that's a brand new book coming out.
Yeah, a friend of mine, a colleague at the Patriot Foundation that gives scholarships to the fallen, wounded, and injured veterans of September 11th, Wesley Baugus has just put out a new book called God, Country, and Golf, Her Reflections as an Army Widow. And I think it's a fascinating book, another veteran author, and she's out right now promoting it. I just wanted to thank her for what she's doing, and I know she's been through a lot, and let her know our prayers are with her.
Absolutely, and you showed me that book beforehand. I think it's very interesting, A God, Country, and Golf. It's a very interesting title.
Yeah, it's very fitting for the Sandhills.
That's right. Now, let's stop now here and go back to your book and say, okay, we've piqued the audience's interest. How do they get a hold of your book, and what do they do?
So I'm here locally doing a lot of different talks and book signings. I'll be at the Country Bookshop on the 10th. I'll be at the Outpost in the library in Pinehurst on the 13th. I think I'll be at Sandhills on the 26th. On the 20th, we're having a book launch party in Pinehurst. The 27th, I'll be out at the Sandhill or the Southern Pines Brewery. So I'm popping around the area. I'll be teaching at Sandhills in the fall. It'll be a textbook there. And, of course, it's on Amazon, as everything in the world is for sale on Amazon, so you can get it there. But here locally, if they contact me and want a signed copy, that's available as well. So,
do you have a website, or you just go through your school?
They can go through my Facebook website, Jason Chris Hauk, my author webpage, and contact me there or leave a message. And also on Twitter, they can find me as well.
All right. Do you have any more book signings coming up?
Those are the big ones for now, and then I just finished in Chicago last week, and I'll be heading back out of the city in August. But in July, I'll be all around the Sandhills.
Good, good. And I think we'll probably hear more from you. I expect there's going to be a lot of interest out there for your book, especially this, the aspects of it being a modern interpretation. And then that very helpful notion that it's chronological. I think that's very, very unique.
I hope that helps people to put it in better perspective. It's tough to read a book that's written out of sequence for most Americans.
Absolutely. Well, I just want to take this time now to thank you, Jason, for you coming on the show today, and also thank you for your service to the country, as an Army veteran and then as an FAO, and then what you're doing now to expand our understanding of this religion that is so forward in the news every day.
I appreciate it. Thanks for your service, too.
All right. Thank you. For the audience, we'll see you next week when we have another veteran from North Carolina talking about their story and talking about the things that they've been doing.